You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 330. And joining me today is Doug in Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
Andrew in Southern California.
Hey, guys, what's up?
And Bill in Northern California. And I'm hailing from Central California. So today, Doug came up with our topic, and that's on fossil fuels and the electrification of archaeology. So, Doug, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, well, so I know this episode's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks, but definitely gas prices aren't going to have fallen at all by then. And so, you know, as the most of the U.S., I think, is at like $4 or $5 a gallon. But you guys are in California, so what are you guys at, like 18, 20 bucks a gallon or something?
I wish it was at $20 a gallon. Then you'd actually see some real change in transportation. No, it's still like...
It's six.
Yeah, 579, 580.
Yeah. So also, you know, we have like about 25 years before the world needs to hit like net zero before things get really crap. So probably within the next generation or so, you know, electrification is going to happen whether you're pumped about it or not. So that's the topic, discussing about, you know, what electrification means for archaeology, how it's going to affect us and our work. And yeah, you know, life in general.
Yeah, I like the topic. I just, as someone who's done research in the Virgin Islands and has visited Hawaii and snorkeled and stuff, I'm watching how fast the reefs are getting destroyed and how fast in the Caribbean the water's like feels hotter than bath water during the summer. And I'm just, you know, watching all this stuff, you know, in real time trash things. And living in California, it's like on the cutting edge of everything burning down, then everything landsliding away. So climate change is, you know, pretty central to what's going on.
Well, Doug, I am curious. First, I think I'd like to hear what are you talking about what CRM specifically should be doing for to become electrified? Or are you talking about how we are as professionals going to work within a larger field and clients and project sites that are becoming electrified, or both?
It's kind of both, because essentially, in a way, we're being driven by our clients. So like if the clients are requiring electrification, we kind of don't really have much of a choice. Like, so big thing here in the UK is essentially the highways. So there's several large highway government bodies, and they've basically mandated that fairly soon, most of the construction, and so this will be large infrastructure projects, will need to basically be aiming towards net zero or heading along those ways at a fairly strong clip. And part of that, to reach that, is electrification. So it's basically coming down as a lot of mandates. So whether you want to or not, fairly soon, at least in the UK, on large infrastructure projects, yeah, things are going to have to be electric pretty soon. Like we're talking the next couple of years, and already it's starting to trickle down into archaeology. So we're seeing, you know, diggers that are electric, solar powered welfare units. So, you know, your little cantina and stuff are now ending up being not diesel generated power or anything like that. They're now ended up being a lot more electric, sometimes with some solar panels on top, sometimes not. But essentially we're ending it down there. So you could say you might be able to resist it, but usually, and maybe this is, you guys have a different experience, but my experience, when a client sort of says, this is how we're going to do it, if there's not really a health and safety reason not to, you're pretty much going to do it. And that's how it ends up being. So I don't actually see archaeologists being too much of a lead on this, But, well, actually, I do see archaeologists being leads on this, but I see the push mainly coming from clients. And that's...
What do you mean by archaeologists can be leads?
Well, in the sense of... Yeah, in the sense that we get the mandates, but how it's implemented is usually up to the archaeologists. So in a way, archaeologists are kind of usually at the front line because also we tend to be a bit early in the construction process. So in a way, they'll be like, oh, everything needs to be electric on this project. And of course, the first people who actually need to deal with that implementation will usually be the archaeologist. I don't know, maybe you have a biologist or a geologist or someone else in that sort of pre-planning environmental workaround that needs to do electrification. But usually it's going to be the archaeologists who are the first ones who have to figure out how to do things electric. And then in a couple of years, everyone else will.
Yeah, that's interesting because I think when I'm thinking of lead, I'm thinking, yes, of course. So you're talking more about schedule, like we're the first ones that are involved. And so, you know, those mandates are visibly going to be seen first by those that are implementing these initial assessments rather than being the considerable contributor to the electrification. Because our footprint and ability to be electrified is going to be significant, and our impact and the benefits of us being electrified are going to be significantly less than, let's say, a construction contractor, right? Because quite a bit of what we do doesn't even need fuels. Now, if we're talking about fossil fuels only for the movement of vehicles for electricity, we're not talking about, or are we talking about fossil fuels and petrochemicals, such as the products that we use to do our work? Because those are two different things when it comes to, you know, looking at fossil fuels. Are you just talking about the electrification, like, let's say, our vehicles, the pads that we, you know, iPads that we use, how do we charge them up? Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about full scale minimizing the reliance on fossil fuels by every single component of where fossil fuels are injected into our society, including all the products that we use?
So I was originally thinking more, yeah, vehicles, electrification that way. But I'm happy to also pivot and go with the full thing as well, because there is quite a bit about, like, how do we replace things like plastic bags? And there's been quite a bit of work on that as well, which ironically...
We all three of us live in California, and they don't have plastic bags here pretty much anymore. In fact, very frustratingly, they have brown bags and can't even put a handle on the brown bags, but that's a whole story.
Well, not only that, but the bag is so cheap. So, yeah, but for the longest time, I've been using cloth bags for like 20 years or so now. So it's not that big of a deal for me.
Yeah.
So when you're talking brown, like brown paper bags, right?
Yeah. Right. But they're so thin and cheap, man. Dude. It's horrible. If a drop of rain touches it, it just goes right down to pulp.
Yeah. They just fall apart instantaneously. I don't know if you guys are like me. I've been hoarding my precious plastic bags.
Yes.
I'm like, where am I find them? I'm like, sweet, there's three plastic bags here. I got to keep these.
We have a cat, so the litter, it just goes down.
We're going to have to start
buying bags for the kitty litter.
I was just thinking that. I mean, here's, like, if you want to get, and I really would like to focus on archaeology because that's what I'm very interested in as far as how is it specific. We could go so many rabbit holes, but, you know, you want to talk about your cloth bags. Those are made of synthetics, and the synthetics are made from petrochemicals. Petrochemical products. So it's not as obvious as a plastic bag, but they are petrochemical products. So, but let's get back to archaeology, because that's really what I'm interested
in. I'm thinking the vehicles could absolutely be electric. You know what I'm saying? I think that definitely 90% of the archaeology that I've done in my entire career could have had an EV, now that I think about it. We absolutely didn't really need to be using gas all those times, except for a couple of times when we were way out in the desert. But like every single one of them was within 100 miles, because then there's the whole issue of people lodging and all that other stuff. And I think that, you know, if you'd found a hotel chain that had electrified, or I mean a charging station for your vehicle. You can just leave it overnight, right? And like, I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking we probably could have been using EVs like almost all the while.
But when you were doing CRM, how long ago was that, Bill?
I mean, I'm still doing it now, and I'm still driving a car, and I rent
I'm talking about full time.
Okay, yeah, full time, probably like 2014 is when I ended 40-hour a week CRM.
I think back then that would not have been possible. Now,
yeah, probably. Now
I do believe it's possible. Okay, we have hybrid cars, trucks, and we'd probably be going to full electric. And that is possible now. A few years back, that was not possible, but it is now. So, I mean, it's just whether, you know, fill up your gas tank or you charge your truck. Now, the one thing is, you know, if you're going, like you said, out into the boonies, you know, being able to find a charger, having to cut your, it definitely creates a need for more planning. And it does take longer to charge up the trucks. So, you know, all of that needs to be factored into the cost of a project. So it's not as easy as just, which I'm not saying you guys are saying that it is, but it's not as easy as just switching over to the electrification of our vehicle fleet, because it does, all those costs need to be factored in. And the time, the cost of time needs to be factored in. And unfortunately, archaeologists aren't that great at factoring those costs in. And so sometimes it's just easier not to do it at all. I do think it's possible, but it's going to take some effort to do that.
Well, I'm kind of thinking, I'm not sure how much effort it really would take, because many companies are leasing those cars anyway. And so once the lease is up, or if you're renting cars too, right? Like you're renting vehicles to go out, then it, like the time that you need to rent a vehicle to go out to the desert, you just go to Enterprise and you get an F-150 or whatever, or a Jeep or whatever you're going to take, but you just, you know, lease or buy Priuses and hybrids. And I don't know, there's a bunch of hybrids. Like those are good for the monitoring, the site visits, the really quick shovel probes, you know, two people going out to take photos of a building. Like those absolutely could be a choice. And that, and once again, if your company's not buying the cars and they're leasing them, it's seriously just the minute the lease is up, you just switch over to Teslas or Priuses, right?
I'm actually not talking about the cost of the vehicles. I'm actually talking about, you know, the everyday. Now, still takes due time to pump gas, but it does take you considerably longer right now to charge.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, so a super common task that I used to have doing CRM was, you know, you're going to go monitoring for this ditch that's going to be excavated in whatever county. And you look and it's seriously like 25 miles away. So tomorrow you show up to the place, you don't drive your own personal car. You get into one from the carpool that, if you know, you were at the right place that had the charging station there in the parking lot, you left it in the parking lot. You hop into your Prius. I go out there, I've got all my gear, and I just sit there for 10 hours or 8 hours or however long they're excavating. When they say they're done digging for the day, then I turn around and go back. Like that's right. a super common activity that all of those minimal activities could totally be to, or you have a godforsaken meeting with whatever water district people, you know, and you must go in person to see this dignitary, that thing where you drive all the way to whatever town. I mean, that could have just been like, we have our Priuses just chilling out there, or we have our Teslas and we just hop in it and we go, and then we come back to the office and we get in our real car and go home.
I'm not being a naysayer here. All I'm saying is that with CRM, it definitely depends on what kind of company you work for and the ability for that company to pivot to electrification. If you're using a very, you know, if it's a small CRM firm, their ability to shift or the funds that they have in order to shift to electrification is going to be different than a larger company, if that larger company is committing to that effort. And so I think that our footprint and our ability to impact the benefits of electrification from CRM is small compared to other entities on a construction site. But, you know, everybody can do their own part. But I don't think that if you're talking about being leaders as far as the chronological aspect of a project, being the first contractors on a site, yes. But if you're talking about leaders being able to make a considerable footprint in the electrification of a project, we are like a fraction. That's not to say that it's not worth it. I'm not saying it's not worth it, but I am saying our impact on a project is like negligible.
Yeah.
Yeah. The UK is a bit further along. And so they're looking at like not just electrification, but like carbon impact of things like digging. So like if you dig up soil, you actually end up releasing a fair amount. Actually, you end up releasing carbon. I shouldn't say a fair amount. Basically, like it's, again, as Heather was saying, our contribution to an overall project, we're probably a rounding error on like an overall carbon budget for a project easily. Like archaeology, even when you're taking into account like every other thing that can contribute to carbon, like digging up and everything like that, they'll release some carbon into the air. It's almost nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, like basically, yeah. If you had whole numbers, we're not even there.
Right. So, you know, I'll finish the segment with the just this thought. You know, the one thing that I think people make the mistake when it comes to trying to be more, you know, electrification, let's just say, or just the general climate approach, climate change, or, you know, approach when it comes to looking at other modes of fuel, people really tend to go through into the rabbit holes. And, you know, that I think we get in our own way when we're talking about moving dirt, which is true, I guess. I mean, I hadn't heard that before, but when you're talking about moving dirt or you're talking about the gas, the farts from cows, you know, you're definitely missing the forest for the trees. Not you personally, Doug. I'm just saying that in general, when we start focusing on those little things, that's where, in my opinion, it gets ridiculous. Let's look at the larger areas where we can actually make a difference, where we can be reasonable, where the cost-benefit analysis makes sense, where the benefits of doing something, A, will actually provide enough benefits that the cost of doing A is offset. So with that, we'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 330. And we're talking about fossil fuels and electrification of archaeology. This is Doug's topic. I'm going to start off just by saying, you know, this past week, my daughter and I went to go visit a family friend who just got a Tesla. I had no idea that you could change. And this is really important to the electrification and the responsibility that we all have in, you know, being net zero. That a Tesla can do this astounding thing. You can change your honk to a fart sound. Did you guys know that?
Usually I just actually fart when I...
Yeah.
I was like, you can change all, you know, can make it. There's so many little quirky things. It was actually kind of fun. Yeah. I've been in a Tesla before, but I haven't played around with the screen where you can do all these different things. Dude. Anyway, it was fun.
All right.
But I have played around. So I'm going to push it over to Andrew. I am
muscle car Andrew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to rant.
Yeah. I'm going to piss on your Cheerios.
So Andrew, comes. I want you to sell me because right now, like I'm just going to be forthright. I do want to be responsible. And I think, you know, but I'm not a electric car or go bust type of person.
You.
Like I'm always looking at, to me, like I said, when we finished the last segment, it's a cost-benefit analysis here. Yeah. Is the benefits that we're going to get outweighing the cost?
Right.
So I'll just buy
a Honda Civic, gas-powered. Moving on. So anyway, guys.
Or Toyota Echo, my favorite car.
Yeah, no, so I think about this a lot. Amazing. I think about this a lot. And I have to say, look, I am a tree hugger. I am a cliche surfer, Southern California, you know, kind of person. I agree with Bill totally at the top of this. One thing that freaks me out more than anything is the temperature of the Caribbean, like in some areas going over 100 degrees. I find that so scary, right? And I do want good things for this planet, but you have to be a realist at the same time. And behind the scenes, I'm a total gearhead, right? I love cars and all that kind of stuff. But we have to think about this idea of electrification as a mandate versus electrification as reality. classically what California specifically is terrible at. And what we have to do is take a step back and think, what is clean? What does clean really mean, right? At the end of the day, it's not just electrification. Electrification is just a way to carry power, right? So if in your city, you have a coal burning power plant and you have an electric car and you virtue signal around going, look at my electric car. You're like, you're just carrying energy made by coal that was still burned and is in the atmosphere, right? Mm-hmm. So we touched on this earlier with the infrastructure. The infrastructure is just a mess with all this. Like, we have to get our infrastructure together. And so before all this makes any sense, first, we have to build nuclear power plants. The end. Like, I don't care about hearing about solar. I don't care about hearing about wind. And I'm a fan of solar and wind. But look at the percentages. Look at how much electricity you need, right? Per city, per county, per country, whatever. I've looked at this stuff. Solar and wind can't do it. Period. The end, right?
They're not reliable. They're not reliable.
They don't make enough. Period.
Oh, hold on, guys. Huh? We'll talk about like a modern country. I'll let you guys rant about America.
What, your country that has 14 people in it? A real, you know.
Actually, we're like the size of California, I think.
Huh?
Where are you guys at? Like 60 million or something like that?
Yeah, but it doesn't.
Oh, we're bigger than California. We're bigger than California.
Yeah, well, still.
Population wise, not land wise.
Like, we can virtue signal all day and go, I love. And the truth is, I love solar power. Like, we put solar power panels up at Moorpark College where I work, and I thought that was great. Like, I'm so happy we're doing that.
Right.
But it doesn't bridge the gap, right? And so the only way is nuclear power, period. We can be children and go, I don't want to do that. Or we can be adults, right? Period. You don't do that. You will continue to burn coal, which we're still doing, and so, oil, which we're still doing.
Okay, first of all, I have a question here. Doug, are you talking about Scotland or are you talking about the UK? Because Scotland has nowhere near the amount of people that California does alone. Mm-hmm. We have we have almost 40 million people, and you guys have like under six.
Oh, no, we're like at five, if barely. Okay. I might be slightly boosting our numbers up to hit five. We might be at four something and change. Like,
I just looked at it. It's 5.6 million.
Yeah, that's, I mean, half of that's Glasgow. Actually, maybe like three-fifths of that's Glasgow. So UK. So I'm talking you, because like Scotland decades ago became self-sufficient, and we produce more energy, more green energy than we can ever use or use in a like multiple lifetimes. Like, our wind power, it's bone of contention in Scotland because the electric costs are nationalized, are countrywide. So we end up having to pay much higher electrical costs being part of the UK. It's a whole thing about the independence, yada. We won't go down there, but I will say UK wide. So 2015 was the first time they did a day without coal-powered electricity. And within the last decade, they've completely gotten rid of coal. And just this last, a week ago, we pretty much, this is mainly because sun came out briefly, but we got down to less than 2% of electricity across all the UK was from fossil fuel. And they're estimating sometime, we don't know when, but sometime this year, we are going to hit basically a fossil fuel-free electrical grid on a day, sometime, probably during the summer. Probably in the next month or two, we get like our sunny week. But
using
like,
what? Doug, using
so
what?
That's a mixture. So
a combo of sun and wind.
It's sun, wind, hydro. So there are still some. We do have some rivers, and there's Scotland has tidal up near Orkney, but not too much. There's tidal with bays and stuff like that. So, but tidal, don't count. That's pretty much a rounding error.
But is that
well,
reliable? But, that's you're going to get one day right. because you got one day with sun. Is that reliable? That's the key to being free of fossil fuels. That's what we're aiming at, is reliable yeah. energy, not energy that's backed up by other options that are powered by fossil fuels. So first of all, electricity is only 1/5 of the energy use. So we're only talking about a fraction of the fossil fuel issue that people yeah. are have that, you know, it, I'm interested, first of all,
so, well, what I'm saying
I am going to burst your bubble here. Yeah, because
no,
what
I'm saying is,
no, I want to hear it. I want to hear it because I also am going to burst the other bubbles here because I'm with Doug, dude. I hear this stuff all the time about how we can't do it. We got to have nukes. We need all this other stuff. And I'm absolutely. Shaking my head as people are clicking on shit on their phone and throwing away laptops yeah. and all this stuff. Like,
yes.
people are not as efficient as they could be.
You're right.
And
you're
they're
right,
saying that we can't move away from coal. So I want to hear Doug.
No, I'm not saying that's the case. But you guys have to be smart about it.
Yeah.
Like, not Heather, you guys, we need to be smart about it. We're going down rabbit holes.
People hang on, I hear. I want to hear.
Cow farts.
But then
there's more efficient ways.
Heather, that's what I'm saying is like a decade ago, we basically had our first day of coal-free, and now we're completely coal-free. So we're about to have our first day of fossil fuel free. God, that's a tongue twister. I think everyone knows what I was trying to say. And we're going to hit that this year. And it's not going to be like a utopia where suddenly we're free, but probably within the next decade, we're going to be there. And that's so when we get to the car, like back to cars and stuff like that, I definitely have some, I have an electric car. I have a full thing. I do think some people are being overly optimistic and false advertising on certain aspects. But same thing with the electrical. Like, essentially, we will be there. That's not necessarily like a consequence-free sort of, we're just going to plug in green energy and the world is going to be okay, sort of things like that. There is going to be a cost. I mean, we have levies in our taxes to help pay for that, yada. It's why electricity is quite expensive here. Actually, there's a whole bunch of reasons why. Actually, yeah. It's fossil fuels why. Like,
what's the backup for the
Hang on.
Just curious.
So our backup is essentially with a big enough grid. And like, you're thinking of us as an island, but actually we're connected across to the mainland as well. So mm-hmm. we're connected to France, we're connected to Norway. It's not as cost effective to send electricity over hundreds of miles. You lose a little bit of energy every mile, whole right. physics, if you physics class, stuff like that. But essentially we're at the point, like we're back. Actually, we produce so much. What you end up with is actually a bit of inefficiency, and by a bit, probably a lot, where the wind will be blowing, but actually right now in Scotland, the wind blows and they actually turn off the turbines because it produces so much. We literally have things because essentially they've done a whole thing where they've pushed up, basically all of our electrical and gas meters are now connected to a grid, so you can see instantly, you know, how much you're spending. It's all been this whole thing that took like a decade. But part of that means is like about once every 2 weeks, I get an email that says, you can spend electricity for free during these hours. So go for it. Basically, because they have so much electricity that they end up giving it away, and they could track it because they can track what you're spending on at certain times and stuff like that. Because if you've gotten the digital, you know, electric box and digital gas meter and all that stuff. So if you've got it digitalized, basically they can track it. And essentially we get these things that are like, yes, between 5 and 7 on Tuesday, your electricity is free. So put on the dishwasher and the dryer and the washing machine and charge your car and whatever. Have a dance party with like a rave with a ton of lights. Turn on your Christmas lights just for the heck of it. Like, so we're at that point. So like it's a different switch, but basically it is actually going to end up being inefficient for energy companies that they're going to have a lot of solar. And they're going to have a lot of wind that they're actually going to have to turn off when they could be making money because they're going to have so much spare capacity. And that's what you end up.
It is a mix. Energy storage.
I'd like to add. It's, well, here's the other thing, though. I'd like to add real quick. It's not just the energy in Europe. It's the overall society, right? Like, it's taking away places for cars to drive and park so bikes can ride. And it's like setting up lanes for e-bikes. It's, you know, having things closer and compact. It's people not having gigantic fridges. It's people without 2,600 square foot, four story mansions in Phoenix that have three AC compressors, right? It's like a more sensible way to live just overall. And then they've added that into it, right? And in the United States, we don't have that. We have people sprawled all over. Dude, SoCal is the epitome. And it's baby Phoenix is even worse. Same thing with Denver, all of the Southeast where everyone's moving to Houston and Texas. Those are energy destroying like black holes, right? You can't make enough energy for that kind of useless, wasteful growth in construction. And in the United States, it seemed like, you know, hey, I'll just not use a paper bag at the store and I'll have an EV and I'm going to solve it. Dude, like in Houston, right. There is no solving that. There is no solving it, right? There is no solving Dallas. I'm from Boise, Idaho. What they're doing there, there's no solving that. For 1,000 years, they won't be able to fix it because they're building stuff in stupid ways that requires a boatload of wasteful energy to keep it going. So those comments about us needing to switch over to other sources and how do we store and all this other shit, to me, I'm like, how do we cut back? Like, how can we have more families live in the same subdivisions? Like, how can we have more reliance on transportation? How can we cut back on the energy we're using or have more people using the same amount of energy rather than expanding the supply, right? If they started if they did the opposite, if they rationed power in the United States, you'd start seeing change. Like, hey, we only generate this much. So by 6 o'clock, all the lights are going off unless you guys start saving money and energy.
You're going to see shit change. Yeah, you're going to see that administration voted out and then the next administration come in and be like, we're turning the lights back on.
They're the same administration, man. There is never a change in the administration. It's all Microsoft. Yeah. There is no administration. It's like, only when, other corporations telling us what to do with a different face, shape, and color of the skin.
Look, that's too much. Can I bring it back
slightly to more practical?
So, like, supposed to be my rant. Okay.
Well, I was going to join in on Andrew's rant as well, but I would also say it's like, so there's also different ways of storing it. So like here we have water. So and this is like in the Highlands, they have reservoirs that they pump water uphill and then they lay it down. And this is from like the World War, like this is not new things that they've built. These go back to like World War II where they used to have a reservoir and then when they need electricity, they'd pump it down the pipes.
If you're in the Highlands, you could just have the Highlander there. He could store all the energy in his sword.
I was going to say, you have to kill one Highlander and you'll get enough energy to power your house.
Yeah.
But there's also like, so they're changing the taxes here. They're looking to change the taxes here because right now, if you sell your electricity back to the grid, you have to pay like tax and or coming in and out and stuff like that. But basically, they're going to change it because essentially, a lot of people with the vehicles, you know, you drive in the morning, you go to your office, if you still do that, which, you know, with all the return to office mandates, more and more people are. And then your car sits there for most of the day and it comes back. And so they're actually setting up, like they've added the technology to the new vehicles where essentially they could store a lot of energy in the vehicle. You plug it in and then if there's a shortage, they pull it out of your car and they pay you for it. And then you charge at night when there's low use. So essentially, everyone's car is also going to act as a reserve electrical storage for a lot of things. So I know we've kind of gotten into the weeds a bit on like the technical aspect of these things. I am not too, they've solved most of these issues in other countries other than the US. So it is possible. I would say we go back to a different topic instead of sort of thinking about the practicalities. This is mostly solved in like also countries that like are not very conducive to electrification. So you got like Norway where, you know, Arctic Circle in some parts and things like that. And I think I'll go look this up, but it was something like they only sold like 8 petrol, what they call petrol here, but you know, gasoline powered vehicles in like January or December or something like that. Like they've almost gone 99% of all new vehicles are electric. And that's like, you know, pretty cold places. Like we're getting North Dakota cold sort of places. So a lot of technical aspects have sort of been solved on the electrification, but not all of them. I guess we can come back to Andrew's rant about electric vehicles, because I also have some things about like, it's not going to be a one-for-one replacement to your gas vehicle, and people need to realize that.
I'm going to throw a little bomb, then we're going to go to a break, because that's the, you know, the luxury of being the host. Did you know that more people die from cold than they die from heat? So I'm not sure where the Denmark, you know, as far as it being a colder climate and being able to effectuate the actual energy saving. But anyway, I think.
Oh, sorry. It was Norway and electricity. So electric vehicles don't do as well in the cold.
Yes.
So we can come on to that into the next section. So what I was saying is like, even in places where it makes less sense at the moment to be electrified, they're still doing it and doing it quite successfully. So that's the point I was going there. We could pick up that thing on electric cars in the next segment.
Yep. Okay. We'll be right back. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 330. We're talking about fossil fuels and electrification of archaeology, although we really haven't talked about archaeology all that much. I would really like to, you know, focus, at least have some part of my issue. Again, I'm not against, you know, being energy efficient, not at all. But I, again, we need to be practical about it. And I do think that, you know, some countries have been able to, you know, get down this path quicker. There are reasons for that. You know, we can't ignore that this is the expanse of the United States, our economy in the United States, whether you want to agree that's bad or good, it is tied to fossil fuels. And, you know, the type of population that we have and the fact that we are the leading country when it comes to, you know, the increase in technology, you know, the inventions, not that other countries don't come up with those things, they do, but we are the leading country of that. The competition that is bolstered by, you know, capitalism that does increase our ability to live better lives. And fossil fuels are part of that. Can that be transitioned? Yes, it can, but we need to be smart about it.
Right.
So real quick, I think that waiting is the opposite of smart. And I think that a lot of the things that we're talking about are things that have already been invented, right? And then I'd also totally argue with quality of life getting better, man, because I'm raising kids and I don't even know what to say. So I don't think that the quality of life's getting better because we have more iPhones and a bunch of Teslas and stuff. But I am saying
I think that we need to
figure out a pathway sooner rather than later, man. Sooner rather than later, because every day that we're burning more of that stuff, it is trashing the world. And every time we say that I don't think that we can do it and I don't think we can move forward, like that's another day that we just choke on our own gases. You know what I'm saying? And the faster you can figure it out.
You want to talk about quality of life. In the last century, since fossil fuels have been increased, we have gone 98% down in deaths. And that is all because of fossil fuels and what fossil fuels have allowed us to do. So, you know, there are about, I looked up these numbers, 3 billion people that use less energy a year than we do for a typical refrigerator. And they use dung and wood, which is what people used to use before for, you know, power. And that is, you know, you want to go back to those days as far as quality of life.
With our much longer lives, we have more time to contemplate all the directions a lot of ways we are not going in the right direction. So let's use those longer lives to make a more environmentally sustaining world. Okay, but also I wanted to get back to the archaeology thing, right? Because
yes.
In its essence, most of the time, archaeology is actually pretty low tech. We don't use a lot of devices. And so I don't see how we couldn't just have a like portable charger. Like I've got several of them that either you charge it up before you leave the house, or you could charge it if you had like a Ford Lightning or one of the bigger EVs that actually has the ability to charge. Like, I don't see how we can't charge things like blowers and iPads and other stuff like while we're in the field. But also the other thing is like in general, I show up with the GPS already charged, and I show up with my iPad already charged. The same thing with the camera battery. So in general, like, I think archaeology is actually already quite energy efficient. Like, you know, we're not the ones who are driving the backhoe and stuff. So what more could we really do outside of the office to make it more environmentally friendly?
That was actually one of my points, is that, you know, I think we're already, a lot of what we do is hand powered anyway. If we want to go down, like what I just said, don't go down a rabbit hole. I'm going to go down a rabbit hole for a second. You know, if we're trying to do the, you know, the battery packs and the iPads and going fully digital, you know, it, you also, to be fair, have to look at what is that generating? So it's not just the fossil fuels that power our vehicles to go forward. What about all the products that we use? All the products, but, you know, wood screens, one thing we can make, don't buy any more of those plastics. They stink anyway, unless you're hiking up a hill. But, you know, the petrochemicals are in every single product that we have. You cannot get rid of fossil fuels. You just can't. So that people have to be a little bit more, I don't think people realize that. Now, we can make an impact when it comes to electrification.
They can virtue signal all day. You know, and be like, I am against this. It's like, as they're sitting in their car that's made out of plastic. And yeah, it's like, just look at the data. That's what drives me so crazy about
it. And it's not to say change can't be made. It can
be made.
Exactly.
Or that we're not doing it.
But why are we demonizing fossil fuels?
Yeah,
use fossil fuels for what makes sense.
We kind of got into the weeds on, like, will it happen? Why it should happen? All that sort of stuff. I was actually more thinking about some practicalities of, I think it's going to happen whether we're not the drivers of this. And I was hoping our conversation could go a bit more about sort of practicalities and what those impacts will be. And I do have some thoughts and some data and stuff on, like, you know, non-plastic bags, and also talks about, like, if we go to electric vehicles. But how about we start with Andrew and his rant on electric vehicles, which I think might be a good segue into where I'm trying to go with.
All right.
It's not going to be a one-for-one replacement, and those are the things we need to be thinking
about. I just want to say, we've talked on here before about, like, what vehicles to get to CRM, and I did want to round it back to CRM. And I would just say, as a gearhead, I would say very shortly, basically all cars built since around 2018 or so are built like total shit. So just realize that, whether it's gas, whether it's electric, they're built to not last. So what you're getting in this country, we're getting really worldwide, is a move from cars that can be fixed to cars that you throw out. Like, all cars are like that. Electric ones, I would say, are the worst, you know, in terms of not, you're not being able to reuse your own electric car. You use it for a while and then it is over. You throw it out, right? And which I find is awful. You can't rebuild them. And also the cost, like, they are so expensive, and they are very way too overly complex. So they have way more stuff to break. And if you're on a typical CRM archaeology project and you have a choice between an old Ford F-150 that runs on gas and a brand new electric truck, which keys do you go for? You know what I mean, you know? And again, I'm a fan of electric cars. I think their rollout has been terrible. They're way too expensive. There's way too much crap on them, and they just won't last. They're so complex that once they're dead out in the middle of the field, they're dead. You can't bump start them. You can't fix them on the fly. It's just over. And I do see, like, if any of you guys have seen that Slate company that comes up online or a little bit, they're trying to do what electric cars should be, which are cheap and basic, because the electric technology is actually very basic. But the way these are made now are terrible for archaeology. We are losing the ability to buy the quote unquote $3,000 car. It basically doesn't exist, because you either have something from like 2010 or earlier that you can work on and basically keep forever, or you have something newer that you're throwing away. You know, and so actually this goes on
like everything else in our society.
Yes. Like, what car are you going to give your 16-year-old? Where is the $3,000 car, right? It's going away. I would say, everyone listening, keep your 1999 Toyota Camry. Keep that sucker, right? Like, I find it really sad. And, you know, that's just sort of my rant on cars. I would love an electric car. I love the idea, but I'm not going to spend $60,000 on a car. Are you freaking kidding? You know, I'm not going to do that. I can't do that. I don't have that much money, right? So like, that I get so sick of the electric car virtue signaling horseshit. You know, I'm like, give me an electric car I would really want. Give me an electric car I could really buy. Give me an electric car I can fix when it breaks down. And they just don't have it. And it's all of them, whether it be Tesla, whether it be Ford, they're all the same, you know? And so we're on a totally wrong foot. And don't get me started on hybrids. Hybrids are two cars in one, twice as much technology, twice as much to break. There you go.
Oh, excellent. So it's perfect because like Andrew's caught a lot of things and I'm like 98% in agreement with Andrew, except right. for like a small little thing that I think turns it around and puts us both on the same side. I would say your rant is exactly what I feel, but I would also say that is for all modern cars.
Yeah.
I mean, like all modern cars are now essentially a mobile phone on wheels and yeah. they all suck. They all, well, actually, so not all, because like you guys, unfortunately, because there's tariffs, you don't get like the cheap $10,000 Chinese version of electric, yeah. which yeah. I would,
they're doing well.
I love those because, oh my God, give me a crank window. Like a window that you yes. can crank yourself. Because like as soon as your electric window breaks, yep. oh my God, they have to basically replace the door. Oh. Not the window. Imagine
BYD, the Chinese company, they're doing it right.
Yeah, insert a bunch of expletives that I'm sure Chris would not appreciate me saying. Like, but like on all of them. And actually, what I would actually say is when you were like the old 1998 F-150, mm-hmm. I would actually go with that and then replace it with an electrical engine. Because actually,
oh, yeah.
electrical engine, like some of the best things I've seen is actually you have a whole, guys, go on YouTube. There's a whole DIY, like converting your vehicle. And usually it's old vehicles because you can just go to the dump and buy like a shell from your Honda Civic from like the 1990s that like crank windows, everything works except the engine. And you replace it because modern electrical engines have basically, I'm going to get the number wrong. It's either 12 or 17 parts. And that's it. Like versus a modern gas, and even modern is still last 50 years, have hundreds of moving parts.
Yeah, it's way more.
And with electric, you don't even have you don't have to worry about transmission. There is no nope. transmission. Like, it is the simplest vehicle you could possibly get.
Yep.
And so what I would say
but they is actually, screwed it up.
Well, but it doesn't matter. Like you get yeah. a modern gas powered vehicle and it's the same thing where it is basically tons of, remember like, what was it last year? Prices of cars went up because the supply of chips got damaged because of that fire or something at a factory. And like, that should not, like the price of computer chips should not be a dictating factor on the price of your car.
Yes.
That is horrible. And so like, I'm completely with Andrew on all of this.
Look at that. Come except together.
Except for, I would say just the better one, the easier one to fix is actually the electrical engines. That's fewer moving parts. Mm-hmm. But go back and like, yeah, get your 1990s or 1980s or 1970s, whatever vehicle it is, take out the engine and replace it with an electrical one and your life will be like infinitely better. And also I would say this goes back to my sort of rant about like, I think electric has been missold as well, where Andrew was talking about the cost, like buy a used one. The resale value on them sucks so bad that like, we got an electric vehicle and we didn't want it. Like the salesperson was like, oh, it's got leather seats and all this stuff. We're like, yeah, I don't care about that. And like, and it'll heat up the steering wheel. I was like, yeah, don't care about that. I'm only looking at the price. Like we ended up getting like a top of the line model it was 3 years old and we got it for a quarter of what the person bought it for new. Cause the resale is so bad.
The hard part is with the battery storage, you know, that's the whole thing with the used electric vehicle. Will the storage maintain?
So that's one of those ones where like, if you, and again, this is one of the things where I think people have missold electric vehicles. So you got to treat anything like a lithium. Most of them have lithium batteries. This is changing. Probably if anyone's listening to this podcast in like 10 years, totally different battery thing. But essentially, we charge 20 to 80. So when we get down to about 20%, we start charging back up. And we don't charge unless we're going on like a longer trip above 80%. And essentially, if you do that, and piece of advice for you guys is phones as well. Like if you have a mobile phone or, you know, sorry, a cell phone for all of you in North America, like that's the way to preserve your vehicle. It has to go with the chemistry. I won't go into the weeds on this, but basically try to keep anything that's electric, be it your laptop as well. If you can have the software where you can change like where you charge up to and down to, but basically you want to keep between 20 and 80%. And if you're doing that, you're losing less than 1% battery capacity per year. So they basically say you'll probably need to at about a 70, when you get down to about 70% is when you're going to have to, you know, you should probably replace your battery. But if you keep your vehicle, you know, take care of it, your electric one, you're talking 30 years. And honestly, if you haven't done it yourself and put it into the 1998 Ford F-150, your vehicle is not going to last 30 years anyways, because all the other electronical crap will break on it. Yeah. And that'll cost you more than the actual engine and replacing the battery. But honestly, like the need to replace the battery is, it's a non-factor. And when you get an electric vehicle, if you're someone like me, who's going to keep it for 30 years or try to, attempt to, we'll see how, like our current one is a bit too modern for me. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. Like, honestly, God, give me a crank window any day. Right. Like back when like electrics basically was like a wire straight to your, if you had AC, or also to your radio / CD player / cassette player,
right,
depending on your age. Like that used to be the only things in electrics in a vehicle, you know, a couple of yards of wire, as opposed to now they're like, oh, if you put all the wires end to end in your vehicle, it would stretch for like 20 miles. And you're like, yeah. Jesus, why?
That's why. Yeah, exactly. That's it. It looks like you nailed it. And another quick top tip, don't buy a car that has like automatic windshield rain sensors, because when you chip your windshield and need a new windshield, it's not going to be $500. It's going to be $3,500, right? So these stupid technology, like expensive BS, I can't take it.
I think the easiest way though to make our industry more efficient is get rid of the office. Nobody going in anymore, man, because that's
we are human beings.
Everybody,
we are primates. We need others.
But let people socialize with their others that they actually like, instead of the people that they're forced and paid to be around, right?
It's good.
So if it was me, I'd be like, nah, man, just no more, no report to office mandate.
100%.
And the only way that you can come in is if you take the bus or transit.
No, unhealthy.
Anyway. Well, also, but like, if I could slightly swing back to like the changes that people are going to have to make, is like, so again, everyone's trying to do like a one for one. Oh, you can just replace your gas vehicle with electric. Right. And that's not like, you can get those superchargers, but it's not for every vehicle. And also, that does tend to wear out your battery a lot faster as well. But it is also not as bad as people think it is, because essentially, with a fairly decent charger and most modern electric cars, you're probably looking at, again, if you're aiming for that 20 to 80 rule, if you get down to about 20, you can drop off a fairly decent charger. We're not talking like the 300 kilowatt hour ones. We're talking like ones that might, like mine maxes out at 21 kilowatt hours per hour, but essentially 30 minutes, 30, 35, and it actually is, it forces you to kind of do what you're supposed to do, which is not drive for like 8 hours straight before you take a break, but actually like drive for a couple hours and then like get out and walk around for like 15 or 20 minutes. But
that's not going to work for business though. You know what I mean?
It does go back to
places.
It does go back to like how there's, well, I mean, it depends where. I mean, I have done those whole, like, if you're going out to site and you do need to drive for like 8 hours straight to middle of nowhere sort of thing. But generally, you know, it's not going to affect commuting. And for shorter projects, or if you're just, you know, if you're at a hotel and you're then just going out to the site, and it then becomes a cost as well. Like the company is not going to pay you 4 hours or 6 hours. They're going to make you get that hotel in that crappy town closer to the site. So you're not really looking at that as affecting it. You're, those long journeys, like if you have to go all the way across state or multiple states to get to the site, you know, maybe at the beginning of your 10 on, 4 off week or something like that, you are going to have to do a little bit more stopping. But honestly,
a geography thing, because the American West, it doesn't really work, you know, for a lot of this stuff, unfortunately.
I mean, like with a lot of the modern ones, they're doing like 400 mile range.
Yeah, and I kind of disagree about that too, because like, anything that wasn't requiring us to leave and go to another hotel, like, you know, 100 miles away, we totally could. We were not driving more than 200 miles to the site, or, I mean, I don't know. I think it can be done with most EVs.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of those ones where they've, when you actually sort of sit down and do the math, like other than that, you know, that full drive day that you might have to do, which might mean that you have to add an extra half hour in there for breaks for charging. But again, it's a lot of those. I mean, 400 miles is quite a big distance to go. That's almost your entire day anyways. I don't think it's quite there. I think people will need to make some changes and that you need to affect that. But also, sorry, one little thing to just throw in there for people thinking about electric vehicles. Again, one of the missold things is whenever they give you mileage, ironically, electric vehicles are sort of a reverse of gas vehicles, and that you get better mileage inside a city with electric because they all have those regenerative brakes. So as you brake, you get more electricity back. And actually, if you're going like, you know, highway and stuff, you're going to have worse mileage per kilowatt, which again, it's one of those things where I wish that people who are trying to sell these vehicles would be a bit more honest and just say like, you know, like man, mine, so technically the range is 150 miles. I'll be honest, on highway, it's possibly 100. But if I'm in the city, it's like 250. And they really do missell that. So I don't know. It's ones, and also they missell like how much it's going to save you as well. It will save you money if you're charging from home or charging, you're not one of those superchargers. But if you're going for like one of the supercharger places, they're charging you like, you know, $1 a kilowatt hour, $1.50 to, and then when you actually start to do it, it's not saving you that much money. But sorry, I still see these articles. They're like, oh, you could drive from York to London for only $5 on electricity. And it's like, well, yeah, if you like stop in someone's backyard and use like their charger against their wall and charge it for like 12 hours at a time where it's super slow, it's not realistic. It's not, electric vehicles are not going to save you as much money as everyone who somehow manages to pull out like their calculator online and put together these little articles about, oh, you'll save like $10,000 in like the first year on not having to pay for gas alone. And it's not realistic. It's still better. It still will save you money, but they're definitely overselling it. Yeah. I think we've gone way over time.
I'm pretty sure Heather wants us to wrap up. That's okay. I think, you know, I think what I'm getting from this discussion is that, you know, our imprint, our ability to be efficient from an electric or fossil fuel perspective is minimal. I think it will be interesting to see how other contracting companies outside of CRM that we are working with all the time, construction companies being, you know, the number one, are going to be reacting to this electrification. I mean, there are public entities and infrastructures, some projects that we're working on where the public agencies are requiring certain infrastructures to absolutely be, you know, net zero by a certain year. And it will be interesting to see how those that we are adjacent to when we're working are going to be reacting to that, and what kind of efficiencies, hopefully, and new technologies that's going to bring that maybe eventually we can take advantage of in CRM. So with that, thanks everyone for the lively discussion. That wraps it up, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for joining. We'll see you in the field.
See you guys next time.
Bye.
Adios.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archpodnet.com/CRM Arch Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at archpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.